I'm sure we've all been reliving this pretty much constantly this week. Just to remind you, 26 seconds left, all pumped full of adrenaline. After that Jermaine Kearse catch, we were riding high, sure that fate was on our side. And then...
Lynch in the backfield. Russell looks, throws inside. Oh, my...
Okay, stop, stop, stop. Please, I don't think I can listen to that again. So anyway, as the heartbreak has begun to fade, it's gotten me thinking a lot about failure. You know, what does failure mean? Is there some kind of value to it? And then I just remember that look on Russell Wilson's face right after that play. And I just wonder, is there anything anybody in the world could say to that guy to make him feel better in that moment? So as we often do when we have this kind of quandary, we put this question to a panel of experts, fourth graders at Somerset Elementary in Bellevue, and ask them what they would say to Russell Wilson in those moments just after the Hawks completely blew it.
People learn from their mistakes, so I think that next year we'll win the Super Bowl because you learn from your mistakes.
I would tell him that it's an accomplishment to go to even one Super Bowl. So if you went to two and won one of them and barely lost the second one, I think that's an accomplishment and you should think about half glass full, not half glass empty.
Don't be afraid to admit your mistakes.
If it's one person's fault on the team, then it's the whole team's fault. Like, it can't be one player whose fault it is.
If you're a good team, you have to win some and you have to lose some and you have to learn from your mistakes.
I understand why, like, it was hard for them because they, like, everybody was, like, depending on them to win the Super Bowl, so they had a lot of pressure.
So to recap my little 10-year-old life coach's advice, be positive, admit your mistakes, share the burden, know your limitations, and, you know, just take it easy on yourself, Russ. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect. This week, coming off a tough loss, we will be sharing some upbeat and offbeat tales of failure. But before we do that, we have invited some very successful journalist types to join us and help us get caught up on the week's news. That's coming up next, so don't go anywhere. Well, the vaccine conversation is nothing new in the Northwest, where we've been struggling with this for as long as anybody else has. But it kind of feels like maybe we've opened a new chapter in this discussion, or maybe it's just sort of yet another in a long line of flare-ups about this that's been playing out over and over again. Well, that's our top story this week, and we're going to be talking it over with our guests. We have Tracy Record, who's editor and co-publisher of West Seattle Blog. Luke Timmerman is founder and editor of The Timmerman Report, which is a subscription-based biotech news site. And Rachel Lerman covers technology and retail for the Puget Sound Business Journal. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Sound Effect.
Morning.
Good morning.
So we're going to be talking over that top story as well as our nominations for overreported and underreported stories of the week. But for starters, is the vaccine discussion getting anywhere? And maybe, Luke Timmerman, we could start with you since you cover biotech. Does this feel like the same conversation we were having 5-10 years ago, or has something changed?
It's pretty much the same conversation. It's a little different in that I think a lot of this is driven by autism. People are afraid of autism. It's poorly understood. They don't know where this is coming from. And the scientists will tell you that too. And there have been some studies done which have been discredited that suggested there was a link there. But it caught on with certain celebrities that helped popularize this idea that maybe vaccines have something to do with autism. It's caused a lot of consternation in the scientific community because this has been discredited. There's no good evidence for it. And vaccines are just such a no-brainer as public health interventions. They contributed to increased life expectancy the whole last century. They're cheap. They're safe. They're super effective. When I look at the controversies in healthcare around drugs and diagnostics and pricing and all kinds of things, vaccines are just about the least controversial thing you can find.
Well, this has really bubbled to the surface again in the last few weeks with, of course, the Disneyland measles outbreak. And that's had tendrils here in Washington. A couple of those cases have turned up here. And we had another case unrelated to Disneyland that came up in King County just this week. And, you know, in observing the conversation, it just feels like at least a lot of people think it's kind of turned a corner. And Rachel Lerman, I wonder if you have ideas about that. I mean, do you feel like the conversation has changed at all?
I don't know necessarily that the conversation has changed. I think what we do have now, though, are we have kind of like what Luke was saying, more loud voices saying, oh, there's a link to autism. This could be dangerous for your kid. But I don't always know that that's the best way to approach these issues with some people. If you believe something, you believe something. Throwing the same evidence at people over and over and over again isn't necessarily going to get them to change their minds.
And in fact, there's some studies have been done that show that more evidence not only doesn't change people's minds, but maybe polarizes them even more.
Sure. I mean, one of the most interesting pieces of this conversation to me is the bill that was introduced in the state legislature. Should we allow parents to exempt their kids for moral and religious reasons from vaccines? And if so, should those kids be allowed in schools?
That bill would still allow medical exemptions, as far as I know, but would take out the sort of personal belief exemption possibility, which would probably lower the rate. And we just heard some really interesting reporting this week about the different rates of exemptions at various schools. And Trace Record, did you get a chance to look at that?
Well, there was one particular school in West Seattle that is an alternative public school that had a relatively high rate of exemption, about 23% at Pathfinder K through 8. But after that, the most interesting thing that struck me, I've seen around edges of this debate some demonizing of immigrant cultures as thinking that somehow people who come to America aren't perhaps choosing to immunize. And the most interesting thing is that the rates of the schools with the highest percentage of immigrant population, such as in the High Point area of West Seattle, where we have a large East Africa immigrant population, they had a very, very low rate of exemption. So that was kind of a little nuance that nobody has picked out of this yet. And we're in a time now where with so much information available, you can't always say, oh, I'm just trusting my doctor, she or he knows everything. And that's kind of where this has happened. And it's, you know, sort of arisen to this point where now suddenly the fact that Disneyland has had a measles outbreak and now we're all talking about grabbing people off the street and forcing them into a van to get a shot, almost.
Yeah, well, in some kinds of more, I don't want to say coercive, but sort of legal type of solutions for this, as well as pretty strong social pressure, right? I mean, people are really getting into it online in particular. Do you think it's getting more polarized?
Oh, absolutely. Right now, what struck me is the fact that it reminds me of the coverage note of Ebola virus just a couple of months ago. Not that that was something that directly affected people as much as vaccination, but it was getting to a hysteria point where you almost thought that suddenly we were all going to get this virus and die. And then the coverage just evaporated. And that's the tone. And I'm a former TV news producer, so I know how this thing sort of snowballs. Right now, everywhere you turn, suddenly people are talking about this as if there are piles of bodies arising on the streets. And not to at all downgrade the importance of this and the fact that there might be a child with a serious illness that got exposed to a non-vaccinated friend and suddenly they're fighting for their life. But it really is kind of at a hysteria point now where I think it would be helpful to dial down a tiny bit.
In fact, this is your nominee for overreported story of the week, Tracy Record. And Luke Timmerman, I wonder, do you agree? I mean, do you think that we have kind of lost our sense of perspective in terms of the stakes?
Yeah, I think it's important to keep things in their proper proportion. But the fact remains that vaccines are a story that will come up from time to time, and people should pay attention to the basic facts now while they're being reported and make mental notes about, gee, how are our schools doing? How many of them have gotten to that 90% necessary to achieve the herd immunity, to basically make the virus run into a brick wall?
Okay, so Rachel Lerman, what's your overreported story of the week?
Well, in case you hadn't heard, the Seahawks did not win the Super Bowl this weekend.
Seahawks? See what?
Yeah, they're a sportsing team, I hear. Yeah. They did not win the Super Bowl this weekend, which is, of course, a very important story for our city. It rallies a lot of community support. It's huge for our businesses. It's big. I also think there's only so many ways you can say Pete Carroll made a bad call.
Luke Timmerman, this was also your overreported story of the week. How long is it okay to continue sort of gnawing on this particular story?
Well, you know, it's funny. I used to work in a daily newspaper, and we had sayings like there was breaking news, things that just happened right now, and then there were second day stories. Those were things that you would come back and be a little more thoughtful of on the second day. And then by the third day, I mean, most of us have moved on, but the Seahawks story just keeps going and going and going, and it's about time for it to go away.
So like 4 days afterwards, it's still covered like it just happened.
Yes.
What is a fresh wound, everybody? So we're going to talk a little bit about our nominees for underreported story of the week here in our Sound Effect Weekly News Roundup. Rachel Lerman, do you have an underreported story of the week to nominate? Hey, it's Gabriel Spitzer here from Slightly in the Future. Just a quick update. Shortly after our panelists walked out of the room as we taped this on Friday, we discovered that this underreported story stands a decent chance of becoming next week's top story. The port operators announced that they would, in fact, shut the port down for the weekend and resume operations on Monday. You can find out more about this developing story at kplu.org. But for now, back to the discussion that we had on Friday about this looming possibility. Okay, back to the past.
We've been hearing that the ports could literally shut down in the next couple of days because of a contract dispute between the Pacific Maritime Association, the ILWU, International Longshore and Warehouse Union. This has been coming to a head for quite a while now. We've been seeing port congestion for a couple of months, but now the PMA is saying, well, we've given you our best contract offer. This is our best offer.
PMA is the employers.
PMA is the employers, the ones that operate the ports, and they're telling the union, we've given you our best contract offer. If you don't take it, the ports could shut down.
Well, this has been one of these stories that has been simmering for a long time. But Tracy Record, you are our editor and co-founder of the West Seattle blog, where things are much more sort of up close and personal, right? I mean, you have seen this very much in your daily life.
We've actually literally seen it in our daily life because the fact that the ports have been running more slowly, regardless of who is to blame, the employers or the longshore workers or both, and off one side on Elliott Bay, there have been freighters anchored waiting to get into the Seattle ports. And then there's this holding zone that we can see from western West Seattle off Manchester and Kitsap County. And there have been, if you look at marinetraffic.com, which I love, five freighters almost around the clock waiting to go to Tacoma. And we learned that that's an approved holding zone for Tacoma. But the one thing that I think kept this from really getting on people's radar is that there was a thought before Christmas that maybe all these freighters waiting at anchor to unload their stuff would mean shortages at the stores and you couldn't get the Legos or, you know, whatever else. And that didn't happen for whatever reason. And therefore, this has just continued at sort of a slow simmer until this new threat of shutdown.
Yeah. I mean, and what would happen if the ports were to shut down? Is that something everyone would notice?
I don't know about the actual direct effects, but I know that there would be a lot of money lost somewhere. Somebody was just throwing around a figure of, you know, a couple billion dollars. It would be rather calamitous. The one interesting thing that has been pointed out, we wrote this into a story maybe about a month and a half ago, is that as people make pitches overseas for ship your goods to Seattle and Tacoma, and it's a really heated competition, we're competing against ports to the north and to the south, to the east coast, that they're losing credibility. They're going over there and pitching this, and then people who are prospective shippers are saying, well, it's been a 6-week delay for my stuff because of this crazy disagreement you people have going on.
I'm going to Canada.
Actually, that is something that is really happening. The Port of Vancouver is seeing a boost in business because people are shipping their things there because they can still get their products through without that 6-week waiting time.
But now this is where it turns into more of a macroeconomic story that's harder for people to get their arms around, because we all hear that Washington State is the most international trade-dependent state in the country, right? A huge part of our economy depends on this, but it's hard for us to put our individual fingers on exactly how that affects us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you think about perishable things like Washington State apples just sitting in shipping containers waiting to get onto a ship, then it becomes pretty dire indeed. So, Luke Timmerman, what's your underreported story of the week?
Oh, as a biotech writer, I always think biotech.
Wait, let me guess. Biotech.
Yes. One underreported story has been a local biotech company called Juno Therapeutics that went public a month or so ago. It's been a huge success on the NASDAQ. It's worth about $4 or $5 billion at last count. And they've got a method for stimulating the immune system to fight cancer. This is a new technique to sort of re-engineer your T cells. They take out certain immune cells, re-engineer them, and put them back in so that they can attack the cancer. And they've seen really encouraging results in severely ill cancer patients, upwards of 80% of them surviving. So there's been a lot of excitement, and it comes from the Fred Hutch and Seattle Children's, the foundational technology. And interestingly, the Fred Hutch has an equity ownership stake in this company. So it's actually going to be quite lucrative, and it will help plow money back into basic research at the Hutch.
Yeah, it's been a big windfall since that IPO for Fred Hutch. So maybe that's something we'll be seeing the repercussions of. Well, Rachel Lerman covers technology and retail for the Puget Sound Business Journal. Luke Timmerman is the founder and editor of the brand spanking new Timmerman Report, which is a subscription-based biotech news site. And Tracy Record is editor and co-publisher of West Seattle Blog. Thank you guys all for being on Sound Effect.
Thank you. Thank you.
Great to be here.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week, like most people who live in this part of the country, we are dwelling on failure. Well, one area where failure is kind of not an option is birth control. Now, of course, for women, there are a few different options for avoiding getting pregnant. But for men, there's really, well, there's abstinence, which I'm sure works for some people. But mostly, there are two ways to do it. One involves a condom, and one involves a scalpel, and they both have drawbacks. But for decades, doctors have been trying to create another option, a birth control pill for men. And believe it or not, the male birth control pill actually did exist. It could have been a huge game changer. And scientists here in Seattle got so close to making that happen. But eventually, they failed. KPLU's Jennifer Wing has the tale.
Back in the early 1960s, researchers from the University of Oregon and the University of Washington created a pill that stopped the production of sperm. You see, doctors were developing drugs to treat worms in people, and when they were testing the drugs out on lab animals, mice, rats, they couldn't breed them anymore.
No one knew how they worked, but they thought, well, this could be actually a wonderful male contraceptive.
That's Dr. John Amory, a professor of medicine at the University of Washington.
So they started testing them in more species, and eventually they tested them in humans. And they worked well in humans. They were free of side effects. They didn't affect sexual function, hormone levels. And the investigators thought, wonderful, here we have this drug. We don't know the mechanism, but it seems to safely and effectively suppress sperm counts, and then when we take the drug away, the sperm production comes back.
The drug was called WIN-18446, and I wondered, you know, women are so used to the idea of taking a birth control pill. Would guys be up for this if they had the option? Would they bear the responsibility of taking a WIN pill?
Knowing that it wouldn't lead to pregnancy.
Yes! In a heartbeat. Yes!
This is Blake Saunders from Kirkland and Marisha Madrono of Seattle. I talked to them outside of a bar in Wallingford.
If you think you're going to have sex, right?
Nope.
You take it every day the same way as a woman takes a birth control pill. I like it.
Yes.
This is how most of the men reacted when they heard about WIN-18446. Tons of enthusiasm. So how did scientists back in the early 1960s know that WIN worked on people? Well, Dr. Amory says the experiments with the WIN pill
were actually being performed in prisoners. It was common at the time. It's no longer done. They were thought to be ideal candidates because they were in one place, they wouldn't disappear. If something happened, you'd know about it in terms of safety.
Things were going great. 50 to 100 men were taking the drug for about a year with no horrible side effects, and then
they discovered that there was a real catch.
Alcohol. You could not take this drug if you drank alcohol.
They found this out just by coincidence. One of the inmates flagged down Dr. Alvin Paulson, who was an investigator at the University of Washington for many years in this area, and said, you guys have a real problem. You can't drink when you take this drug. And Dr. Paulson said, oh, come on, you know, you were probably drinking cleaning fluid or something in the prison. And the prisoner shook his head, and he pulled out a flask of Jack Daniel's whiskey that had been smuggled into him. And then it was there that they realized they had a problem.
When WIN and alcohol mix, something called acetaldehyde, which is in the same family as formaldehyde, builds up in the body, making you feel violently ill.
You start sweating.
You vomit.
Actually, a few people have even died from these reactions. So it's not trivial.
While the WIN pill was successfully stopping the production of sperm, bringing male testicles back to their prepubescent state, taking them from the size of kiwis down to small plums, it was also blocking an enzyme in the liver. The body couldn't metabolize alcohol and flush it out. Back at the bar, Blake Saunders is having second thoughts.
Honestly, if it made me violently ill, if I drank and took this, probably would not take it.
I can tell he really wants this to work.
Well, so my question then becomes, can you smoke weed? Can you take Vicodin? What vices can I use whilst on it?
Dr. Amory is looking into this, an effective pill for men that could accommodate indulgences. After studying the original WIN experiments, he focused on what the drug did right, the chemistry that was stopping the male body from making sperm.
So what the WIN drug was doing was blocking the conversion of vitamin A, something we all have in our diets, to its active form, retinoic acid.
Testicles need retinoic acid to make sperm. No retinoic acid, no sperm.
Your testis is a very interesting site in that it can't take up retinoic acid from the circulation. It has to make it locally. And what does the testis do with retinoic acid? Well, we're still learning about this, but we do know that in the absence of retinoic acid, you can't make sperm. And that is now our target for developing novel drugs as male contraceptives, hopefully that can reversibly suppress sperm production without causing the alcohol-related side effects.
The drug Dr. Amory and his colleagues are trying to create would act as a key, turning off the production of retinoic acid and stopping the male reproductive system's factory, which makes 1,000 sperm every minute. So when are we going to get a male pill?
You know, I think we're looking at least at 5 and 10 years. If we can get a compound that's effective with daily oral dosing, my next dream is to develop an implant based on the same molecular entity that could be put in a man, and then he could just forget about it for a couple years. I have 2 young sons, 10 and 12, and I think, God, you know, I hope, wouldn't it be great to just send him to college with one of these 4-year implants?
Whatever comes to market will be safer than the option for women. You see, women who take a pill or have a hormonal implant, we have a greater chance of having a stroke or getting blood clots. In the world of pharmaceuticals, those risks are considered to be okay because the other option, being pregnant, puts a woman in a whole new category of complicated health problems. Taking a pill is safer than being pregnant, and for many, the convenience birth control offers is worth the potential hazards. Dr. Amory says you can't make the same justification for a man's contraceptive.
Because the man is not the individual who's bearing the risks of the pregnancy. So the bar for safety for a male contraceptive is extremely high because you're thinking about giving a drug to millions of otherwise healthy young men. So we can't have things like blood clots or strokes, even in a very small percentage of those men, because we can't justify that risk because they're not the ones who are bearing the similar risks, the higher risks of pregnancy.
When Dr. Amory figures all of this out, he'll have at least one man waiting in line to take the pill.
Yes! In a heartbeat.
That story from KPLU's Jennifer Wing. You can learn more about the male contraceptive at kplusoundeffect.org. We're talking failure on Sound Effect this week. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. The Ardeo Theater Project was really ambitious. It was a big group of Seattle theater people who wanted to go make art and live the dream. And I'm going to start the conversation about it with a great big spoiler.
The organization closed its doors to safeguard the interests of students and company members.
Support for Ardeo's launch was significant and generous. However, these short-term challenges made it impossible to continue.
Students will receive full
and
immediate reimbursements.
The story is told in a new play called Voyage for Mad Men, the unbelievably true epic failure of Ardeo Theater Project. I talked about it with its creator, Seattle playwright Rachel Atkins.
Ardeo Theater Project was a Seattle theater company that existed 15 years ago. We bought a chateau in France, in central France, and we moved there with the intention of living as a community, running study abroad programs for college students, and being a theater company, doing theater together. You know, I think living in Seattle, you know, so many people have experience with startup companies, and this was a startup.
Going into this, what did you expect to happen?
Well, the project was masterminded by one guy in particular who literally as a child had dreamed of owning a French chateau, which tells you something about the kind of person he was. And so that was really what drove it was this, I mean, I kind of hate to say fantasy because we were realistic, like we were planning a real project, but there was definitely a romance about it of taking control of our destinies and going off and having this adventure together.
So you guys actually managed to do the hard part, right? You bought the chateau, you got yourselves over there. So how did things start to unravel?
It was like there was this black cloud over us from the very beginning. I mean, there were just things that happened, like the day that we signed on the chateau was the worst storm that Europe had seen in 60 years. We literally walked out of the office building where we'd been signing papers, and like there were trees falling, like literally in the street in front of us. It was this unbelievable storm. We had no electricity, we had no power, we had no heat. We had all kinds of damage that a hurricane does when it rips through central France. And then there were still a fair amount of renovations that needed to be made. And as anyone who's ever done any kind of renovations to their home knows, those things never go according to plan. So everything was taking a lot longer than we thought it was going to. Everything was costing a lot more money than we thought.
And you guys were on the clock too, right? Because you had, it wasn't just you. It wasn't just a bunch of young adult artists who could hack it if they needed to. You were involving a bunch of innocent bystanders.
Absolutely. So we were preparing to run study abroad programs for college students, and we had an accrediting university. We had students who were applying to come to our program. I mean, we were legitimate. And in the summer of 2001 was going to be our first program, and we wound up having to cancel that because of what was going on with renovations. I mean, we literally had no place for the students to sleep, but we needed their tuition. I mean, the study abroad program was going to fund the art. So we needed to be done so we could bring the students over so that we could survive through the year.
So you've got a storm, you've got a falling apart chateau, you've got expense, you've got bureaucracy, and then you get into this kind of vicious cycle of money and students sort of not syncing up right. And it seemed like it kind of sent you into a death spiral.
Yeah, a death spiral is a good way to put it. You know, there would be times along the way where, like, we would think we're really close to the edge, like, this is all just a disaster, and then something great would happen. You know, some investor would show up out of nowhere and give us a loan that would carry us a little bit longer, you know, or we'd get a bunch more students signing up, and we'd think, okay, like, we're going to make it. It's going to be all right. But yeah, we were definitely on the way down, even when we weren't seeing that we were on the way down, unfortunately.
You got kind of a fateful knock on the door at some point, too, that seems like it was a nail in the coffin.
Yeah, we were raided by the French police. It was really like a sting operation. They surrounded the property. They, like, herded everybody in a room together. They were serious. They were looking for something, and whether it was they wanted to prove that we were a cult.
So wait, what's the cult connection exactly?
So A, cults are illegal in France, and the French, because of actors like Tom Cruise, they believe that all American actors are Scientologists. I mean, they couldn't imagine what else we could possibly be.
Yeah. So wait, what kind of questions did they ask you that led you to believe that they might suspect you're a cult?
They ask things like, who buys your clothes? What do you eat? Who decides what you're going to eat for dinner? We had this very sweet young man named Max Morel, who was probably like 25 at the time, but his name was on a lot of paperwork, and they were very focused on Max. You know, who is Max Morel to you? Who is Max Morel to you? As if Max, you know, this sweet young guy was, you know, our Jim Jones.
How did it begin to become apparent to you that this whole project was in mortal danger?
It was that clock again. It was that the students were coming imminently, and we still didn't really have any place for them to sleep. We still didn't really have any place for them to rehearse or take classes. And we didn't have enough money socked away to know that we were going to survive through the semester. And the idea that we might bring these students over and then have to close down halfway through their semester was just, I mean, that was just impossible. We couldn't do it to them. And if we can't, then we have to just close up shop. I mean, it was an awful decision.
The challenge of making a difficult decision is not the decision itself. It's reconciling to the decision once you've made it.
We should put it to a vote. Option A, we continue with my modified plan of action. Option B, we shut down.
I want option C.
There is no option C.
I can't believe we're really going to do this.
But I'm only prepared for success.
So the story of the RDO Theater project and its pretty spectacular failure is now a new work of art. So in making the work of art, what lessons did you kind of draw from the whole episode? What do you think there is to learn from your experience?
Well, it was a big risk. And, you know, sometimes when you take a risk, you lose everything. But I don't think that necessarily means that you stop risking. I mean, you have to know that that's a possibility. And even if you are only prepared for success, you know, I think there's something to be learned from knowing that you can take an enormous risk and you can lose everything and you're okay. You're still going to keep going. And knowing that you can survive a failure like that, I hope it makes you a little braver or a little stronger or just a little more thick-skinned, knowing that, like, it's okay. It's okay to keep taking risks. If I lived through that, I can live through something else.
Well, Rachel Atkins is the playwright behind A Voyage for Mad Men, and it opens at West of Lennon Theater in Seattle's Fremont neighborhood starting on February 20th. Hey, Rachel, thank you so much for sharing your epic failure with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. John, you want to get us started here?
1998, the Cabin River Bridge.
1970, Russell Barker Memorial Bridge.
1956, Salmon Creek Bridge.
1980, the Alder Creek Bridge.
1923, the Allen Street Bridge.
1962, Gallup Creek Bridge.
1979, the Hood Canal Bridge.
And 1990, Lake Washington Floating Bridge. Well, I feel like those last couple might have given this away, but what we've just been reading is just a tiny sampling of a great big document put out by the Washington State Department of Transportation of bridges in Washington State that have failed for one reason or another. And failing in this case usually means falling down. So to help us explain a little bit more about why bridges fail and some lessons we've learned from some really famous ones, I am joined here by John Stanton. He's a professor of civil engineering at the University of Washington. John, is this a thing in the Northwest? I mean, should I be worried about when I walk across or drive across a bridge around here?
We do seem to have developed quite an extensive history of bridges that have come down. Some of them have better explanations than others.
So this document is by no means like a scholarly comparison of bridge failures from one region to the next, but do you get a sense that there's anything more common about a bridge falling down in the Northwest than anywhere else?
I think we have a number of examples of a very particular type of bridge, namely floating bridges, and we've had two dramatic failures of floating bridges, both since I came here in 1978.
So maybe you could talk about one of those floating bridge failures and tell us a little bit about it, how it came to be and what the legacy of it is.
In 1979, when the Hood Canal Bridge collapsed, it collapsed for reasons which really were not anticipated during the design. Most of the reason is based in the fact that some of the hatch covers on those floating concrete pontoons were not secured in the way that they'd been expected to be. They essentially blew open as the waves started washing over the bridge, because there was a huge storm then. And as they blew open, it was, as somebody remarked, an interesting experiment to see what happened when you fill a concrete box with water and does it float? And the answer is, we now know, it does not float. And with these novel, innovative types of construction, there are usually new questions, new design questions that come up. And it's very hard to think of them all ahead of time. It probably could have taken the cars and trucks going over it for 1,000 years. And those are the things which are studied extensively, and those are the things they got very right. But if you think of it as a chain with a million links, and only one link has to go wrong. And one of the links that they did not plan for was a huge storm, hatch covers coming open, and it filling up with water. And it's just not something that was on their planning sheet.
It's hard to kind of understand, if you're not an engineer, how risky this stuff really is. I did want to ask you a little bit about the Alaskan Way Viaduct. How problematic is that structure, and is it something that you're okay driving on or under?
What I think about that structure could not be put in print politely, in polite circles. You write down the list of things which could be wrong with a concrete structure, and almost every single one of the things you could think of happens in that structure. The foundations are horrible, the reinforcing is horrible, the detailing is horrible, pretty much everything about it is horrible. If I were a homeless person, that would be on the top of the list of places I would not sleep, would be under that bridge.
Are you willing to drive on it or under it?
I go under it occasionally. I don't drive on it.
you truly avoid it?
I truly avoid it, yeah.
Well, that kind of leads us to another example of a bridge failure here in Washington State, probably the most famous bridge failure in history. And that, of course, is the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, Galloping Gertie, which failed in fantastically dramatic fashion in 1940. How famous is Galloping Gertie in engineering circles and among students of physics and engineering?
Oh, everybody knows about it. Absolutely everybody knows about it. It's probably the most famous bridge in the world in some ways. When I was an undergraduate in England an awfully long time ago, we were shown a movie of the Tacoma Narrows Bridge failing.
Dawn of a fatal day, and the wind begins to speak with a roar that no man can fail to hear. In a 40-mile-an-hour gale, the center span weaves like a ribbon in a swinging twist that you wouldn't believe possible unless you could see it as you do now.
I had no idea what Tacoma was. I didn't even know what continent it was on. But here was an amazing collapse.
Can you describe what did happen that day and what it looked like?
Yeah. The bridge had been known to oscillate in wind conditions. And on this particular day, the wind was about 40 miles an hour.
Not that strong.
It's not that strong. It's not kind of hurricane stuff or anything like that. But what it did was it managed to induce in the bridge some oscillations which kind of pumped themselves up and got bigger and bigger. And you can sort of liken this to when a child is sitting on a swing and the loving parent is pushing the swing. If you get the pushes at the right time, then you don't have to push it very hard to make those oscillations of the swing bigger and bigger and bigger. As the bridge started to oscillate, and in fact it was twisting oscillations of the deck, which really did it in the end,
it's a really weird, uncanny movement.
Like, it looks very odd. Yeah, why should it twist?
Yeah, it's twisting like a ribbon or a rubber band almost.
Exactly. And as it twists, what happens is the more it twists, the more the wind pushes it to twist even further. And eventually it just tore itself apart.
Do you remember when you saw that video in the 70s in Europe when you were in school? What did you think when you saw that?
It was fascinating that this could happen, that people could actually have got the design apparently so wrong that it would do this. But it also suggested that there were real challenges when you push back frontiers of science, and they're not simple ones.
This also strikes me as a very human error. One of the documents that that WashDOT has put out summing up some of the lessons learned from this talked about a blind spot, that the engineers really missed something. Can you talk a little bit about that? What was their blind spot?
The blind spot was, I think, largely promulgated by a guy called Mossif, who was the final designer of the bridge, and he was the one who came in with a more slender bridge, which would cost less. There were not very many other sort of big-time, knowledgeable suspension bridge engineers around at the time, and between them, they had somehow persuaded each other that this was the state of the art. And I'm sure there are things that we are doing today which are, again, accepted by the profession as a whole because no one has found cause yet to question them. But there should always be this nagging feeling in every designer that maybe there's something I've missed, and you should always go back and go over and over. And certainly with the students that I interact with at University of Washington, I try to emphasize the idea of keep looking at it from a different angle. Is there something I could have missed? If you look from the east and you think it's all okay, look from the north as well, because it might not look so good. Clearly, that doesn't guarantee success. But if you're aware of your own limitations, ask somebody else, talk to somebody else, see if they've got some ideas about how it might fail, something that might go wrong, so you can deal with that before it actually happens.
That's a mindset, really.
Yeah, we've got to stay modest.
Well, Professor John Stanton teaches civil engineering at the University of Washington. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Engineers are divided as to the cause of the disaster. Some claim it was the use of solid girders. Others differ. But whatever the reason, Tacoma will rebuild. This time a bridge that will not provide a super thrill in the news.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer.
Thank you for helping me roll.
I just want to make sure I really have this right.
We've been on an exploration of failure this week, and now for a melodic take on failure, we've invited this very unique band, appropriately named The Rejections, to KPLU's performance studio. They're unique for a number of reasons, but chiefly among them, they are made up of some of Seattle's highest profile authors and some of their trailing spouses.
I'm Garth Stein. I play the electric bass, and I am an author of The Art of Racing in the Rain, as well as my latest book, A Sudden Light.
Matt Gurney, guitar number two, and trailing spouse of Jenny Shortridge, author.
Ben Bauermeister on fiddle, the trailing spouse of Erica Bauermeister.
I'm Paul Mars. I am the spouse of Laurie Frankel, the author, and I play guitar number one.
I am Stephanie Stevie Kalis. I'm the author of Broken For You, Sing Them Home and Forthcoming, Language Arts, and I play piano and sing a little.
And I'm Jenny Shortridge. I'm an author of Love, Water, Memory most recently, and I am the vocalist.
So, Jenny Shortridge and Garth Stein, let me ask you a couple of quick questions about how you guys got together and everything. How do you guys know each other?
It all started in a coffee shop.
It started after a really botched reading that we, yes, and Jenny and I did.
Where, ooh, a failure. It started after,
yes,
a failure?
Oh, absolutely. Failure. There was literally only trailing spouses in the house, and it was a very big house. Right? And so Jenny and I said, hey, let's get together for a cup of coffee and we can... we can cry together. And that started the whole thing, right?
It did.
So where did the name of the band come from?
Honestly, we kind of modeled it on Stephen King's band, the Rock Bottom Remainders. You know, they had that band for a long time. And so every writer knows rejection. And so to have a band of authors, it just seemed natural to be Rejections.
Tell me even more explicitly, when you say you know rejection, what does that mean to you?
I think that authors are actually... more the only artistic discipline where the authors are actually more insecure than actors. we sit in a room by ourselves for years. Poor hygiene. We just stare at a computer, don't really talk to people very much. We lose track of social skills. And then after a few years, we say, hey, look, I've got a stack of pages. Please love me. And then we are forced out into public.
It's just an occupational hazard, I think, for writers and for most creative types. And, you know, one of the hardest things is that now with Amazon and Goodreads, authors can go online and read zillions of reviews whereby they might not like your book very much. And so it gets harder and harder all the time with audience participation reviewing. And so you have to choose to either turn it off or to blow it off, or I don't know, what do you do, Garth?
With my last book, I was writing this for 2.5 years. I was writing this history of this timber family. And after 2.5 years, I had 100,000 words. And I said, this is great. This is my novel. And I sent it in and my editor said, what on earth are you thinking? This is totally not your novel. And it took me a while to recover from that. And I had to really dig deep and understand that what I had been doing for 2.5 years is doing research for my novel. And so I was writing the history of this family, which then I set aside entirely and then wrote the book. But if I had set out in the beginning and said, oh, for 2.5 years, I'm going to do some character sketches, I never would have done it. I would have said, that's crazy. I'm going to go do something else for a living or something. So sometimes you do have to have that moment of rejection just to get the clarity of your own vision and to clarify what you're trying to say so that you can then, you know, hone your message.
So what do you guys get out of the music?
You know, there's something that happens when people all sing together. We tend to do a lot of harmonies because when you all sing together and all the instruments and the strings are vibrating together, it is a feeling that you can't get any other way, I don't think.
Interestingly, even our very quiet trailing spouses tend to work in solitary environments as well. So it's a little bit of a way to get out of the closet and out into, you know, a social situation that's supportive and we can look forward to every week.
So could you guys take us out with something? You got a little something you can send us on our way with?
We'd love to. This is called Men of Luggage, and it's written by Paul Mars, one of our trailing spouses.
Check your coat, sit down and stay a while. Loosen your ties and up the rope dang your sails. He's waiting on the nightstand when you're picking up the phone. I thought at least you would have figured out by now that same mistake that you'll make over and over. You're burying the past and just digging up the graves. Don't feel bad, I know you'd fight it if you could. Making up the rivals who are knocking down your door. Don't hang around, they might be coming back for blood. That same mistake that you make over and over again.
That same
heartbreak that you'll make over and over again. So travel light. So travel light. Keeping out the cold, you carry that torch for yourself. And I warn you, the flame might just burn you at the touch. You don't want to hear about it all that much. So travel light. Try to retrace your steps. I do not think they'll be coming back for you. Men of luggage, it's okay. It's hard to live this life in your shoes. I don't know what I would do. That same mistake that you'll make over and over again.
That same
heartbreak that you'll make over and over again. So travel light. So travel light.
Well, I want to thank Jenny Shortridge, Matt Ghani, Paul Maris, Stevie Kalis, Ben Bauermeister, and Garth Stein. They make up The Rejections. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. Sound Effect is produced by Arwen Nix and Kevin Kniestad. We had help from Jennifer Wing and Kyle Stokes. Special thanks this week to John Kessler and to Nancy Leeson, who first hipped us to The Rejections. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer, and our online managing editor is Martha Kang. You can find us at kplusoundeffect.org and get in touch at soundeffect@kplu.org. Come on back next week when we'll plunge into Vice.
And he asked me if I'd ever been to Capitol Hill. And he asked me if there were any homeless people there and drug addicts and whatever. And I said yes. And he's like, well, there you go.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.